Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Danu P. Miskin, a clinical assistant professor of neurology at Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals. She offered her insight into the role that cognitive impairment and cognition issues play as a symptom of multiple sclerosis, the current approaches to its treatment and management for patients, and what challenges still remain for the field to address. So, without further ado, let's dive in.
I did a two-year fellowship in clinical neuroimmunology, and that was a mixture of virology and multiple sclerosis. And my title here at Jefferson is clinical assistant professor in neurology. In terms of cognitive issues in MS, there are several symptoms that patients can have. Fatigue, I'm not sure if that's necessarily incorporated in the same group of cognition, but that is a huge complaint amongst many MS patients. And then outside of fatigue, the more primary cognitive issues are memory loss and impaired attention, concentration. And so tied into memory loss is just forgetfulness, repeating questions, and that those sorts of very similar to dementia.
And that I'm glad you said that, because that's where I was going to kind of go. I'm wondering, is there, you know, what's kind of the awareness level of these things? You know, because I imagine anytime we have cognitive issues, a lot of patients probably immediately, especially if it's memory related, go to those sorts of things, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. Right. How difficult is it, I guess, and sort of what's the awareness level on the physician side to identify these things as related to MS and not perhaps, another disease process that's happening in the background?
Sure. I mean, I think at least amongst neurologists, there's a general understanding that with MS comes some degree of cognitive impairment because there are lesions that are occurring throughout the brain. So at some point, that's going to have some kind of cognitive impact. However, as patients age with MS, then you have to take into account memory loss from normal aging and then memory loss from other common things like high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol that can cause like a vascular dementia. And then certainly if their MS is very well controlled and they have minimal lesions from MS and no obvious explanation for memory loss, then they should just be worked up as a general neurology patient would for like Alzheimer's type of dementia. I mean, the field of dementia in general is difficult because there's still not a whole lot of diagnostics to help piece out what is causing what. And in reality, a lot of these patients end up having cognitive issues from MS plus other things.
Yeah, a lot of mixed pathology. And I'm curious in terms of the patients who experience this, is there like a set subgroup of patients or a particular, are primary progressive MS patients or secondary progressive or relapsing patients, is there like a subgroup who are either more at risk for these types of symptoms? Is it sort of across the board or is it depending on the disease phase, it's more likely to occur?
Yeah. So in general, cognitive issues in MS tend to be more of a late stage issue. So it's usually when, even if you start out as relapsing remitting, most people end up with some kind of progression towards the end of the disease course, or certainly primary progressive as it takes its course. At some point, there's going to culminate in some kind of cognitive decline. And that could either be because of just increased lesion burden. As you accumulate more lesions throughout your life, then you're going to take a cognitive hit. or it could be from brain atrophy or like shrinking of the brain that happens in everyone as we age, but is an accelerated process in MS. So that atrophy doesn't happen early on in the disease. So that's why in the beginning, when it's just like an accumulation of lesions, there's not always a cognitive issue as a result of that. But then as they accumulate lesions and as the brain shrinks, then the cognitive issues tend to become more prominent.
And then speaking to that, you know, once the symptom, we know the symptoms are there, they're in the process of developing, sort of how well understood is that, you know, the damage, obviously we know the lesions are happening and most patients are getting regular MRIs or somewhat regular MRIs, depending on their disease progression and their prognosis. But do we completely understand that, you know, it's lesions that are driving this, or is there additional factors that come into play? Just how sort of well understood just is cognition issues in MS?
It's cognition issues in MS is still, I would say, very poorly understood. It's one of the areas within MS that we know the least about, and we have the least in the form of treatments or the least things, the fewest things that we can do to even address them. So everything is kind of more in the form of prevention. So trying to prevent the formation of additional lesions to prevent cognitive issues later on. And so in terms of kind of the pathophysiology of, is the cognitive issue the result of a direct result of the lesion, for many years, the focus has really been more on the atrophy or the neurodegenerative piece, and that really being more associated with cognitive issues than lesions. Certainly, like as I said earlier, as you accumulate a certain burden of lesions, then there's going to be more lesioned brain than normal brain, and so that's going to then have a cognitive impact. But we also send these patients for formal neuropsychological testing with clinical neuropsychologists, which are like PhDs. And their job exclusively is to do an intense battery of cognitive tests to kind of tease out where are the deficits. Is it predominantly executive function or visuospatial skill or attention and concentration, short-term memory, language? And based on the pattern of deficits, they can say this pattern of deficits is consistent with a cognitive impairment that we see in MS, as opposed to this pattern of deficits is more typical of Alzheimer's. So that's kind of the main test we have diagnostically.
And then in terms of approaches to addressing this, because I would imagine, you know, patient is coming in with cognitive issues, we get sort of, okay, now we know what's going on, this is related to your disease process. I imagine they are not super excited to be experiencing those symptoms. So what are some of the key ways, at least currently, that we're using to address these symptoms and sort of help patients kind of get, I don't know, back to where they were, or at least relieve what they're experiencing?
Right. So unfortunately, there is really little that we have to offer patients once they've already developed cognitive issues. And we often refer them to neuropsychologists to kind of grade the degree of cognitive impairment. And then they'll be diagnosed with either mild neurocognitive disorder, moderate or severe neurocognitive disorder. And that's sometimes helpful even if they have that testing earlier on, because then at least it's like an objective means of monitoring for progression down the road. But in terms of what can be done to address those symptoms or eliminate them, it's really ends up being mostly referrals to cognitive therapists like rehab, which is basically like a physical therapy for the brain to try to teach a person how to cope with the fact that a lot of their brain is not functioning properly. Aside from that, there's no real medications that we can give, like the traditional medications that are given for Alzheimer's dementia, because the underlying pathophysiology behind why their cognition is impaired is entirely different.
And so I imagine then a lot of that comes down to prevention, you know what I mean? And speaking, yes, to patients early in the disease process about the importance of these things. And I think that's kind of a trend in medicine as a whole of, you know, especially when we talk about cognitive issues and cognitive related disorders, it's a lot of, well, we need to do things 30 years ahead of time here.
Absolutely.
for you and, you know, just, I guess, in general, what sort of the experience, I don't know how often you've had to do this, but in terms of talking with, say, younger patients who are diagnosed mm-hmm. with MS about, hey, this is something that down the road could potentially happen if we don't get your disease in check. Obviously, you know, a lot of people stress, let's get you on high efficacy therapy as soon as possible to help with that. But in terms of the behavioral things and, you know, the lifestyle modifications, how do those conversations tend to go? Are patients generally receptive to that? Is it, because I just wonder on that, you know, how difficult it is from the physician level to really have that conversation of like, look, I know this is 30 years from now, but this is something we really need to focus on now so it doesn't become a problem. Because to your point, you know, once it becomes a problem, all we can do is alleviate. We can't kind of go back.
Yeah, no, I love that you asked that, because that is something that I'm very passionate about, having these conversations early on with people, no matter how healthy they are. And like you said, initiating high efficacy therapy early on in the disease can really modulate the disease in the long term and in a lot of ways sort of freeze time. So because there's so little that we can do for people once the damage is done, it really is, the emphasis is on prevention. And so I think, I mean, a lot of it, doctoring is reading the audience and seeing if they're in a health literate space to be able to even have these sorts of discussions. Sometimes there's so much going on in their psychosocial life that burdening them with, hey, 30 years from now, this might happen to you, is too much. But if they're generally managing pretty well and their disease is like fairly well controlled and they're maybe not taking it as seriously, I definitely try to, you know, I applaud the fact that I'm glad you're doing so well, but we want you to do, I always use the phrase freeze time. Like, I want you to be the way that you are today for as long as possible. So even if you're feeling great, this is what the disease is going to do no matter what. So you have to be more on top of it and more disciplined than somebody without MS. And it's not fair that you can't really be like, I don't want to work out today. Or you can't really be like, I don't want to eat a healthy diet, because you're not going to feel anything today, but later on you'll pay for it. And so I'm very pro counseling them on diet, lifestyle, and compliance with medications so that they can avoid ever having these like very devastating complications, like the cognitive issues or ending up in a wheelchair.
Absolutely. And I imagine that's kind of a, you know, being able to kind of present that as like, here's a, I know in, as far as EDSS goes, you know, hey, we would like to keep you out of a wheelchair is usually a pretty convincing argument, because I think people have an easy time visualizing that.
Sure.
I wonder, are there any, I don't want to say tips and tricks, but for lack of better phrasing, sort of tips and tricks or resources that you point patients too, in terms of, here's a couple easy ways that, you know, we can sort of get you started on, you know, things like, hey, let's work on an exercise schedule for you, getting you in the gym or whatever it may be, that you extend to patients, or that, you know, other providers might be able to sort of, hey, maybe that's something I can pick up in my practice.
I think the easiest way to get patients into increasing their physical activity is just starting with physical therapy, because they will assess the patient based on what their actual deficits are from their MS. So say all they have is really like right hip flexion weakness, they'll give targeted exercises for that. But then when they come back to me, I ask them how physical therapy went, and then reemphasize that, like, that's great, but now they only, you know, insurance covered 8 sessions for this year, but now it's on you to keep doing what they taught you and incorporate that into your life. Another thing that I often try to get patients to do is just the first thing in the morning is do like 5 or 10 minutes of stretching to try to make it a habit. And I often bring yoga in as an example, because there's a decent amount of data with MS and yoga and how it can be really beneficial, and it can actually help reduce the amount of anti-like spasmodics that they need, sort of like these for the muscle spasms. So yoga is a huge thing that I'm a big proponent of, and then physical therapy, and then just basically using the exercises that they taught you and then doing them on your own. And then in terms of diet, I often go on a lecture about anything close to a Mediterranean style diet. And so seafood, poultry, vegetables, and fruits, like as much of your diet that can be that is better. And then just try to avoid carbs, dairy, red meats. So basically carbs is gluten, dairy is inflammatory and can be inflammatory, and red meats is saturated fat. So all of these things are pro-inflammatory. So I always try to emphasize that don't ever feel that you have to do anything in extreme because it's not sustainable, but you know, whatever, as long as you're aware of these are foods or things that I'm putting into my body that create inflammation. And these are things that are anti-inflammatory. So do more of the thing that's anti-inflammatory. And then another big thing that is within people's control that I emphasize a lot is quitting smoking. And so that certainly doesn't apply to everyone with MS, but there's a lot of data that shows that nicotine can accelerate the lesion formation. And so I have a very strong stance on, you know, what is the point of taking your disease modifying therapy to prevent lesions if you're doing this other thing that's going to create more lesions? And I have gotten the number of people I've gotten to quit when it's explained to them in that way, because otherwise they just hear, oh, cigarettes, lung cancer, like whatever, I'll take my chances. But when, if they actually hear it in a way that's like, you're potentially making your MS worse, those are kind of the things that are within their control, diet and lifestyle wise.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Miskin to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, data from a recent study support the validation of the 1-week Epworth Sleepiness Scale for children and adolescents in pediatric narcolepsy, making it the first study to support the modified scale in pediatric patients under the age of 12 years. The investigators assessed the validity of the ESS and modified it for children between the ages of 7 and 16 years. A total of 100 children with narcolepsy and cataplexy were included in the analyses, with a mean age of 11.9 years. The mean 1-week ESS CHAD value was 14.4 at baseline, which was above the upper limit of normal for the ESS of 10. Most children, around 68%, were taking sodium oxybate, or Xyrem from Jazz Pharmaceuticals, stimulants, or both upon entering the study. The FDA has approved Azurity Pharmaceuticals' baclofen oral suspension concentrated formulation in doses of 25 milligrams per 5 milliliters for the treatment of spasticity resulting from multiple sclerosis. The formulation will be marketed as Flexivi, and the approval also permits the use of the medication for treatment of patients with spinal cord injuries and other spinal cord diseases. The oral suspension formulation is intended to treat spasticity specifically to provide relief of flexor spasms and non-concomitant pain, clonus, and muscle rigidity. It is not indicated for the treatment of skeletal muscle spasms resulting from rheumatic disorders. Finally, patient dosing has begun for the randomized placebo-controlled Phase 2a ADV study, evaluating CY6463, an investigational CNS-penetrant agent developed by Cyclerion, in patients with Alzheimer's disease who have vascular pathology. Approximately 30 participants with a confirmed AD pathology will be randomized to either once-daily oral CY6463 or placebo over a 12-week dosing period. Investigators will assess safety, tolerability, and pharmacokinetics, as well as explore the agent's impact on various disease-relevant pharmacodynamic biomarkers and cognitive performance. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Miskin.
The cigarette cessation is, smoking cessation is an interesting one, because to your point, you sort of see the trends in the general population that it seems like fewer people are smoking. And then every year, you know, you go to ACTRIMS, you go to ECTRIMS, you go to the CMSC meeting, and there's always a poster on smoking cessation. And it's like, how are we still kind of going through this? But to your point, I mean, to that, you know, those sorts of things, is a lot of it just sort of getting patients aware that these are things that they can do. Because obviously that, you know, I know you mentioned a little bit sort of, you know, rehab specialists. So maybe they're going, you know, they get 8 sessions covered by insurance so they can go see sort of an associated rehab specialist that you can refer them to. And I'm sure for the institutions and physicians out there who have dietitians available to them, mm-hmm. they're getting them involved as much as possible, but those things obviously not always available to every, to every patient and every neurologist out there. So, you know, I imagine you'd recommend getting these additional providers involved when possible, but having those conversations and explaining things in a way, like you're saying, how this could be the result of this behavior.
Right.
Do you find that patients are responsive to those things and that they often do dive into them, or is it a lot of times a challenge to adjust behavior? Because I know, you know, especially when we talk about things like sleep, even, you know, mm-hmm. sleep habits, by the time you get to adulthood, it's very difficult to change those patterns. So I'm curious, is that a difficult process on the physician side?
Yeah, I think any physician would agree that when it comes to changing behavior, that just needs to come from within, that a person there, you know, they can be in pre-contemplation until they're ready, you know, you're not going to make, but I still think it's important at every visit, regardless of what stage they are. It's important to just bring it up to gauge where they are in that stage. And so that's not kind of what I do. And if I feel like if the timing is right, then I'll go full steam ahead with my lecture on these are what you can do. Unfortunately, working in Philadelphia with the demographics that we deal with, we're often dealing with patients that are just not capable of even making their doctor's appointments, taking their basic medications. So counseling them on like extra things like diet and exercise is just not even reasonable. But in those patients that I think would be amenable, when I explain it in the way that I explain it, I feel like I make it personal and I try to ask them, you know, what are your barriers? And particularly with the smoking, I feel like the number of times I've had a patient say to me, oh, I was never told that this could be making my MS worse. Like their primary, if they've ever tried to tell them to quit, has just been like, quit, it's bad for you. And so when it's for whatever reasons, they may not care about the risk for cancers or risk of all these other things, but they really want their MS better. So I think it's always worth it to try to counsel patients that are like reasonably health literate and are reasonably in a good space in their lives to be told, because if you don't even try, you know,
yeah, at that point, yeah. And I do, it's interesting to think about sort of like personally tailoring your approach to that, because we talk so much about how great it would be to get to like personalized medicine, but
yeah,
personalizing behavioral approaches and lifestyle changes can be just as effective, I would imagine. For yeah. you, I, you know, getting back to the cognitive side of things, what have there been in recent years, any sort of major steps forward in addressing these symptoms, whether it's new approaches to monitoring or sort of tracking cognitive changes for patients with MS? I mean, how regularly is that being checked in on, and just sort of what are kind of the steps we've taken in recent years?
To my knowledge, there haven't been any great strides in addressing the cognitive piece with MS. It's really kind of the area that we're lagging in relative to other common issues that MS patients have. In from a radiology standpoint, there has been a lot done to try to quantify brain volumes and see if the volume correlates with the clinical decline in cognition. But I feel like that's still more of a research thing and not something that has translated to, oh, we're now on MS patients who report cognitive symptoms getting specific radiologic sequences to do volume averaging. I know that that's being done in a research context, but and then even this sending them to neuropsychology to kind of stratify the degree of their cognitive impairment. Oftentimes when you'll offer that to patients, they will say, well, then how is that going to help me? And you know, they're not always that thrilled to hear that, oh, you know, we would just send you for cognitive therapy to teach you how to deal with it. So I, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there have been any like major efforts to address that piece, but probably because it's just, we don't, it's so poorly understood. And then there's very little that we have to offer if we can identify it anyway. And so it's that like black box of MS.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder then, you know, that you're aware of at least, or maybe you can speak to sort of what you're doing on your end of things, but what sort of work is being done that you're aware of to kind of better understand this? Because again, to your point, you know, it is kind of the looming major challenge in MS, and, you know, we continue to add therapies, new novel targets to the therapeutic arsenal. The pipeline is still somehow bolstered every day, even with the number of therapies available. But this symptom, again, sort of looming in the background, I know cognitive issues and fatigue are kind of the big two that everyone brings up. So I'm curious, you know, what's going on to try to better understand that or try to better address this in the clinic?
I honestly am not aware of anything that's currently happening to try to figure out and better understand why. I feel like in terms of where the field is moving, it's really moving more to try to introduce higher efficacy meds earlier on to prevent these issues from even happening, rather than once it already happens, what can be done symptomatically? Because if the cognitive issues, we're going to attribute it to an increase, an overall accumulation of lesions, so like overall lesion burden or a shrinking or atrophying of the brain, there's certainly nothing on the market to regenerate nerves yet. You know, I think whatever is developed that's going to help with a neurodegenerative piece of MS will also then help in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and all of the other neurodegenerative diseases. So we're just not there yet. And then from the inflammatory standpoint, because that's more of the lesion aspect, it's going hard, hitting them harder earlier on with anti-inflammatory. So you just don't even get to that state. But aside from that, I'm currently not aware of any studies to better understand the cognitive piece.
Well, and that, I guess that sort of addressing the, you know, the root cause of the cognitive problem kind of speaks to the addressing, you know, the goal of therapy in general, to address the root cause of the disease. And that kind of brings up a little bit, obviously, I'm sure you're aware, very recently some data was published that kind of the first time big link to EBV and MS. And obviously it's, you know, the talk of the town right now. I know there's a large portion of the MS community that's been like, this is what's been happening for like 10 years now. So I'm curious, you know, what role do you think something like that might play? Obviously, you know, that opens a whole door to a much larger conversation that we could have. But if, you know, if that, you know, those results were replicated and things kind of along that line of thinking work out, is that then where the field shifts to how can we address sort of this infection early on? And I guess, you know, what are your thoughts on how that may tie into this process?
Yeah, I mean, the EBV thing, it's always fascinating. And it's been decades that EBV has been implicated as the potential trigger to MS. But yes, this recent study is kind of the most robust study that has like shown this correlation. And I do feel that if it does get more definitively proven that MS is a result of exposure to EBV, then the mainstay of treatment would be a vaccine for EBV, you know, to prevent EBV. So that would, I think, revolutionize, because then, you know, if there were a vaccine to prevent EBV and EBV is what caused MS, then we could essentially cure MS. So it's very exciting. Personally, I don't think that it is that straightforward or simple as one virus being the trigger. I think it probably has more to do with exposure to that virus than trigger certain genes to turn on. And then that causes an uptick of the immune system and then a whole cascade. And I feel like that needs to be in people that are genetically already predisposed to have MS. But certainly this recent paper is the most robust data that has come out showing a strong link between EBV titers and people who go on to have MS. So, but yeah, it would be very interesting if we could maybe target it in a in the epitome of preventative measure, which is a vaccination.
Yeah. I mean, I would have felt terrible if I didn't bring that up.
No, that's fine.
too topical. But yeah, to your point, it does almost seem like it's, you know, this domino effect where the final domino is MS and the first domino may be, you know, EBV infection or some other environmental or genetic factor. I agree that it does seem like there's sort of a start point and then some other things happen that eventually cascade into this disease process. I'm curious for you then, as far as just MS in general, and specifically obviously related to sort of cognitive issues, what are kind of the main things that I think that you think rather the clinical community should be aware of, whether it's this need for more research into, you know, the understanding this issue, or, you know, developing some sort of targeted therapy that might be able to help here, or looking into, you know, I'm just curious for you, what's kind of the big need that, not that maybe we can address in the next couple of years, but that we can at least start working toward?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big and most glaring need when it comes to cognition and MS is just to have a better understanding of what exactly it is that causes it. And then if we have an idea of what the pathophysiology is, then we can have more targeted therapies. And then I think also just having some kind of guidelines for neurologists as to sending patients for neuropsychological testing and when to do that, and should it be done on a specific interval? So, because there's something to be said about just studying the natural history of the cognitive issues. When exactly does it start? We think, like I said earlier, it's something that happens more late in the disease. But if we actually had data showing that, oh, over this many years, there's this percent of decline, and we think that's from X, Y, or Z, I think that would be, but the availability of neuropsychologists throughout the country is also a huge barrier. Often insurances don't cover neuropsychological testing. So I feel like in other fields of neurology, like in epilepsy, for example, or in certainly in cognitive neurology dementias, getting neuropsychological testing is just a part of the workup, and it's sort of universally understood that that's done. But I don't feel like that's translated, that that hasn't come down to the MS field as much. Like, I feel like it's one of those symptoms that we hear about and then document, but don't really do much to work it up or to address. So I think the best thing would be to have research done just to have a better understanding of it. And then if anything we can offer patients other than, you know, Aricept or Namenda and these things that are given for dementias, because those theoretically shouldn't work if the cognitive issues from MS, that would be amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it almost sounds like you're kind of digging yourself out of a hole that's already in another hole, because again, you know, it's, we would love to be able to do this, but to do that, we have to do these other things first and understand that, you know, to your point, getting certain things covered by payers, you have to have the data to show that this is clinically, you know, we need this. So yeah, I guess, thank you, you know, for being so generous with your time. One last thing I want to ask is just if there's anything that you think is important to add, or that related to cognition and MS, or just MS as a whole, that either doesn't get enough attention, doesn't get talked about, or just something that you think is worth, you know, worth mentioning.
I don't really have anything that I feel like glaringly important, although I don't know if it's come up at all about COVID and MS or the vaccines and MS.
I guess that's an interesting place to end then. So, you know, I know some data is coming out. We're learning more, obviously, every day, every couple months. There's another study about, you know, the effects of COVID on neurological symptoms and on the brain and in CNS. But I'm curious for you then, you know, what's sort of your understanding right now, or the field's understanding right now, rather, on COVID and its relationship with MS and, you know, patients getting vaccinated versus not and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, so the general consensus amongst MS neurologists is that everyone should be vaccinated, regardless of if they have MS or not, and regardless of which therapy they're on. Certainly with certain therapies, there needs to be discussion about the appropriate timing of the vaccine, but it's unanimous that the overall benefit of vaccination outweighs whatever risk of triggering a relapse. And then when it comes to the relationship between COVID and MS, we have seen, at least I've seen in the last 2 years, patients have what appears to be their first MS flare or get newly diagnosed with MS shortly after having had COVID or shortly after having received the vaccine. And so that has been a great source of stress for all of us, because is it like correlation versus causation? And the way that I understand it is it's no different than this, the theory behind EBV as a trigger. It's that it's still a virus that's stimulating the immune system. And then if there was already that genetic tendency to go into overdrive or autoimmunity, then it's turning on those same genes. And so it's not that the COVID necessarily caused it, but it just unmasked it. And that's how I understand it. But I do think that it's been interesting, because I feel like people always try to blame one specific virus, but it could just be an infectious trigger, not otherwise specified.
Yeah, I mean, and it's certainly, you know, as I imagine when we talk about diseases like this that are very complex and multifaceted and, you know, have multiple phases even to how they progress, it is very hard to say that one thing would then trigger this very complex thing. So I get that thinking as well. And it is going to be interesting to see sort of what we learn more and more about how, you know, especially these demyelinating diseases, how they operate within the context of
COVID. Yeah. I mean, I think in the last 2 years, neurologically, it's just everything that's happened to somebody is within a few weeks of either having had COVID or having had one of their two-step vaccine or their booster. So it's like, you can look back and recount everything as like sort of related. And so what is actually related and what is just incidental, it's a little bit maddening, but what all I've been doing is just making sure I document in everyone when they had COVID and when they had their vaccine, just so that it's in their record, that so that if down the line we find out, oh, these vaccines have tend to cause a lesion in their thoracic cord, then we can go back and say, oh yeah, that we had a certain number of patients that had that. But
Yeah, setting yourself up for a chart review in the future.
I guess.
But that's all I had for you. Again, thank you very much for being so generous with your time.
I know.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.